Now recording. Right, well, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, or a good night, wherever you may be, and welcome if you've joined us in the last few moments on the internet. We are continuing with our Bible study in the book of Daniel, and I guess we're heading down the home stretch now, perhaps next week, maybe, we'll conclude and finish the book of Daniel for at least this time. And you've got to say, of course, with any scriptural study, that there is never a time when we complete a study of any book, passage, or probably even a verse, because somebody described the Bible as being like an onion. You look at one layer and you peel it off, and lo and behold, there is another layer of understanding beneath that, and then you get that, and lo and behold, you can peel that off, and yet another layer, and the scripture are like that, and there's no way that our current study of the book of Daniel covers all the material, and it probably barely scratches the surface. And today we're in Daniel chapter 9, and the last few verses, which are, unfortunately for our sake, some of the most difficult verses in terms of their meaning. There's considerable dispute and debate, some within the churches of God, and plenty with other Bible students out there in the world. So we'll do our best today to look at several of the options. And I said last week, you pay your money and you take your chance. Okay, we'll pick up the story in Daniel 9. You'll recollect from last week, if you're with us, that in Daniel 9, Daniel, a much beloved man in God's eyes, set his face toward God and was praying a very heartfelt prayer. He knew from his studies of the book of Jeremiah, written only a few decades earlier, that God had allocated some 70 years for the nation of Babylon to dominate that part of the world, including Judea and Jerusalem. And as far as Daniel could make out, the 70 years were pretty much over. So therefore, surely, it's time for the Jews to make their way back to Jerusalem and perhaps to rebuild the temple and so on. So Daniel was praying about this, apologizing, repenting for the sins of the people over the previous centuries. And we get down to verse 21, Daniel 9, verse 21. Yes, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. So here's one of God's great angels, the angel Gabriel, sent with a special message to this man much beloved by God. Verse 22, and he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand. At the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I have come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved. Therefore, consider the matter and understand the vision. And I guess it says something that, you know, an angel comes from God and says, Daniel, or whoever it might be, you are greatly beloved of the great God. So we said before, right from the beginning, you know, Daniel was a quite outstanding individual. Even from his teenage years, he had great wisdom, a man of huge integrity, served for decades and decades. He's probably into his 80s at this stage, probably lived well into his 90s or even older. We don't quite know how he came to the end of his life, but a very, very incredible individual. So here comes this angel with a special message. Now what I'll do now is read the next three or four verses, 24, 5, 6, and 7. I'll just read through them, and then I'll read through them in another translation, just to get a sort of a feel for the verses, and then we'll go back and see what we can make of these next four verses. They are difficult. They are not currently all that clear, at least to me. There's different options we can pursue, and they do cause, like I said earlier, some dispute, some discussion among Bible students. So we'll just read verses 24 through 27. Firstly, I'm reading in the New King James Version. Then we'll do the same verses in the New American Standard Bible, just to sort of get a feel for how it comes across. Verse 24. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city, talking to Daniel, whose people, of course, would be the Jews, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. 70 weeks. Verse 25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. This looks like good prophecy. It's already getting pretty odd, enigmatic, and difficult to follow. Verse 26, and after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he, whoever he may be, shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. Well, I hope that was clear enough. Well, it's not, is it? And even the translators seem to struggle a wee bit in translating from the Hebrew into the English. Let me read that now in the New American Standard Bible, which is fairly similar, and then we'll go back and try and pick up some pieces out of it, starting in verse 24. 70 weeks have been decreed for you people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. That obviously makes 69 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then, after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and his end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war, desolations are determined. And he, whoever he is, will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Well, that is actually pretty tricky. And as we go through it, we're going to look at three of the more common or more popular meanings of this passage. The first bit isn't deemed to be too hard, and there's general agreement. It's when we get down to the 7 weeks at the end that the debates start. So let's pick it up in verse 24. The angel's talking to Daniel, who is himself of the tribe of Judah, and says 70 weeks, or the Hebrew is actually 70 sevens, are determined for your people and for your holy city. So it appears that God is allocating 70 sevens upon the Jews and Jerusalem, at the end of which it will finish transgression, make an end of sins, reconcile for iniquity, bring in everlasting righteousness, and so on. 70 sevens. And there is pretty much universal agreement that 77s means 490 years. 77s, 490 years indeed. The Good News Bible translates the verse as 7 times 70 years is the length of time God has set for freeing your people. The Amplified translation says 70 weeks of years, or 490 years, are decreed upon your people. And that, by and large, is the understanding the Church of God has always had. There is a prophecy here being given to Daniel way back, around about 530-odd, 540-odd BC, and it says, Daniel, there's going to be a period of 490 years allocated or decreed or divided off for your people, at the end of which a number of things will happen. It will finish transgression, make an end of sins, and so on. Verse 25. Know therefore, and understand, that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem, which is what Daniel was waiting for, until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Okay, that again is generally accepted to mean that there'll be a total of 69 weeks. That's 69 sevens, which means 483 years if you're good at maths. You know, 7 sevens is 49 and 62 sevens is 434. Add them together, use your calculator, and you get 483 years. So it says basically that from the going forth of this particular command to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah, the Prince, and the word Messiah is a Hebrew word for anointed. In the Greek, that word would be Christ or Christos. So verse 25 says, know this, Daniel, that from the going forth of the command to restore Jerusalem until Christ, the Prince, there will be 483 years. Also, the street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. And what appears to be the case is that the first 7 weeks mentioned here, 49 years, is the length of time during which the Jews went back to Jerusalem and started building the walls, the temple, and so on. A very troublesome time, as it says there, because it wasn't easy. If you are familiar with the stories of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, there was plenty of opposition and threats and intimidation on the outside. And on the inside, of course, there was seduction, because lots of the Jews started intermarrying the nations round about. So it talks here about the street or the open square, the wall or the moat will be built again, even in troublesome times. That does appear to be 49 years at the beginning, when Jerusalem was largely rebuilt. But the key thing that people look at here is that, well, yeah, but from this command until Christ the Prince will be 483 years. And what does that mean? Well, first of all, of course, you've got to identify when you start counting from. And you start counting from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem. Now, naturally, that is not clear, and there's plenty of debate and so on, but the Church of God has always gone with one particular date, which is 457 BC, 457 BC, and if you count down 483 years, you will come to 27 AD, which is the year that we believe that Jesus was baptized and was anointed to do his public ministry. So it pretty much is telling us there, and some people use this as evidence of when you should look for Jesus, is that 483 years after a particular decree went forth, Messiah the Prince would come in his public ministry. Obviously Jesus had been around for a few years already, but he'd been very quiet. It was a private. He was growing up, maturing, but he was of course baptized by John Baptist in Jordan. Then, of course, the Holy Spirit descended on him like a dove. At that point, he was led out into the wilderness, saw off Satan with 40 days of fasting, and then Jesus started preaching. So that would be the fulfillment of this prophecy. From the going forth of the command to restore Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, until Christ the Prince, will be 483 years. Now, the particular decree, if we hold our place there and turn back to Ezra, chapter trouble was there were several decrees floating about at this time, but the Church of God, and to be fair, probably a significant number of commentators pretty much believe that the decree of Artaxerxes, the first, is the one that matters. If we pick up the story in Ezra chapter 7, and we're butting into the context somewhat, Ezra chapter 7, Ezra's page 470, if you're struggling to find it, page 470, Ezra 7 and verse 7, some of the children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the Nethinim, came up to Jerusalem in the seventh year of King Artaxerxes. And this is the man whose decree we believe is the starting point, King Artaxerxes. And this was in his seventh year. Verse 8, and Ezra came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was the seventh year of the king. So Ezra is quite an important man, and he arrives in the seventh year of King Artaxerxes. Verse 10 reminds us that Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Eternal and to do it, and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel, which is quite a good commendation. And you and I ought really to have a similar view of ourselves. You know, Ezra prepared his heart to seek God's law and, of course, to do it. You and I really ought to be able to say that we're like Ezra, that we are a people who've prepared our heart to seek the law of the Eternal and to do it, and not seek our heart to spend endless hours watching baseball or basketball or certain well-known cowboy programs. The things that matter are, looking to God's law and, like Ezra, being prepared to do it. Dropping down to verse 11. Now this is the copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave Ezra the priest, the scribe, expert in the words of the commandments of the Eternal and of his statutes, to Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven, perfect peace and so forth. So Artaxerxes is giving this legal document to Ezra the scribe. Verse 13, I issue a decree. This is the decree that we're going to come from. I issue a decree that all those of the people of Israel and the priests and Levites in my realm who volunteer to go up to Jerusalem may go with you. It was now legal approval to go up to Jerusalem, not just in ones and twos, rather unofficially just scouting out the destruction and so on. This was the King of Kings, and he's saying, hereby is a legal document, hereby is my decree as King of Kings, that anybody who volunteers to go to Jerusalem with you, Ezra, may go. They have full, express, regal permission. Dropping down to verse 18. And whatever seems good to you and your brethren to do with the rest of the silver and gold which he was giving them, do it according to the will of your God. That's quite interesting that King Artaxerxes is saying, I'm willing to support what you're doing, Ezra. You are so respected by me. You honor your God in heaven so much. Take this silver and gold that I'll make available and take it with you. Verse 19, also the articles that are given to you for the service of the house of your God, deliver in full before the God of Jerusalem. And whatever more may be needed for the house of your God, which you may have occasion to provide, pay it from the king's treasury. Whatever you need to build this house and furnish this house to your God, pay for it from my money. And I, even I, Artaxerxes the king, do issue a decree to all the treasurers who are in the region beyond the river, that whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, may require of you, let it be done diligently. So if he comes to you and he wants money, he wants silver and gold, do it, and do it swiftly. No arguing, don't hold back. You honor this man. Verse 25, and you, Ezra, according to your God-given wisdom, you must have been an understanding man as well, set magistrates and judges who may judge all the people who are in the region beyond the river, all such as know the laws of your God, and teach those who do not know them. Whoever will not obey the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily on him, whether it be death, whoops, or banishment, or confiscation of goods, or imprisonment. So this is a pretty strong decree, is it not? This is just basically saying, Ezra, you've got the authority, you've got the approval, you've got the money, you go with all who want to go with you, and you rebuild the house of your God, you furnish it, move on, do it. And anybody that wants to sort of stand against you, they will be imprisoned, goods confiscated, or we might even just kill them. So that's like, wow, that's some decree, is it not? And that decree dates from 457 BC. We just turn to Ezra 9 for a moment. Just look at a couple of verses here. Ezra's praying to his God, and being very grateful, very thankful, also remembering how, in a sense, they don't merit all this attention they're getting. Verse 8 of Ezra 9. And now, he's talking to God, and now for a little while, grace has been shown from the Eternal our God to leave us a remnant to escape, and to give us a peg in his holy place, that our God may enlighten our eyes and give us a measure of revival in our bondage. For we were slaves, and they were slaves in Babylon for many decades, yet our God did not forsake us in our bondage, but he extended mercy to us in the sight of the kings of Persia to revive us, to repair the house of our God, to rebuild its ruins, and to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. And so that is a decree that starts this particular account. So we can go back to Daniel chapter 9, and hopefully verse 25 is a little bit clearer. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem, 457 BC, until Messiah the Prince, there shall be a total of 69 weeks, i.e. 483 years, which will bring you to 27 AD, which is the date that the church has traditionally accepted as when Jesus began his public ministry, at the time of his baptism and his anointing for that public ministry. So it does seem to fit in sort of fairly well. There is, of course, some debate here about the exact year. None of these things are absolutely dogmatically provable. History leaves enough ambiguity for some folk to say, well, actually, it's not 457, it's 458. And Christ arrived not in 27, but in 26, and so on and so forth. But I think the principle is established, and we won't argue too much over a year or so. Verse 26. And after the 62 weeks, there was 7 and 62, making 69 altogether. After the 62 weeks part, Messiah shall be cut off. Christ shall be cut off, but not for himself. So that pretty much tells us that after doesn't mean immediately at the period, but after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And what does that mean? Well, I think we know what cut off means. If we turn to, and it says not for himself, Jesus was the Messiah, he was Christ, and of course, after he came, he was, we know, cut off. He was executed, he was crucified, and it says not for himself. Well, that's the case, yeah. Jesus didn't get cut off for himself, he got cut off for you and for me, and we can see that in Isaiah 53, just turn there for a moment. Isaiah 53, and just read verse 8. Of course, there, the whole of Isaiah 53 is about Jesus bearing our griefs, carrying our sorrows, by stripes we're healed, and so on. Talking of the very personal sacrifice of Jesus for you and for me. And verse 8, I think we're going to. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who will declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgressions of my people he was stricken. And carrying on, they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death, because he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. But it says there in verse 8, he was cut off from the land of the living. And it was for your sake and my sake. So going back to Daniel chapter 9. So it tells us that Messiah would be cut off. And up until then, for this part, things are, like I say, generally speaking, there's a fair amount of agreement. Not total, because that wouldn't be normal for the religious world or the church world, but there's considerable agreement about the meaning of the verses up till this point. It's really the next couple of verses where considerable dispute enters the picture. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. At the end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. And I think we can see in there, without being too sort of dogmatic, that Jerusalem is a city that has seen an awful lot of destruction and desolations, is it not? I know we've touched on it here and there in the past when we were going through the Gospels and Mark and Luke and Matthew and so on, but the city of Jerusalem, it has been invaded and destroyed, razed to the ground, massive destruction, terrible desolations, and there's more yet to come. We know that. So that portion of the verse is not too bad, but verse 27 is where the main differences start to appear. Then he, and that's open to some debate, whoever the he is, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, 1 7, and that's deemed to be 7 years. But in the middle of the week of the 7 years, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And let's just camp on this verse, because this is the one that separates people, and former friends end up throwing things at each other. Verse 27, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for, let's say, 7 years. But in the middle of the 7 years, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Bring them to an end. Not necessary. Well, okay, there's three basic illustrations I've come across. The one which is more traditional, more universally held among the Church of God, is that he referred to here in verse 27 is Jesus Christ himself. He's been talking about Messiah. The prince shall come, Messiah shall be cut off, and the belief is, this is the most common among God's people, is that verse 27 should read, then he, Messiah, Jesus Christ, shall confirm a covenant with many for 7 years. But in the middle of the 7 years, he shall bring an end, if you like, to the necessity for sacrifice and offering, because obviously Jesus himself would be killed. And after Jesus' death, he is our sacrifice. No need for any other of the burnt offerings or sacrifices, because Jesus brought an end to them. He was the perfect sacrifice, once for all, Day of Atonement type teaching. And so therefore, this means that Jesus would confirm a covenant for 7 years, but in the middle of it, of course, he was cut off. Now, we believe Jesus ministered for 3.5 years, at which point he was crucified, killed. So that would sort of make sense here. He confirms a covenant with many for 7 years. In the middle of the 7 years, he brings an end to sacrifice and offering. 3.5 years down the road, Jesus is arrested, crucified, killed, goes to heaven. Okay, let's just hold our thought and turn to Hebrews chapter 12 for a moment and see that Jesus indeed is described as a messenger, a mediator of a covenant. So it says here that he confirms a covenant with many. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 12, and we can see that Jesus does indeed bear the title, and it's one of his functions to be a covenant maker. Hebrews 12 and verses 22 and 24. Verse 22, Hebrews chapter 12, you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. Verse 24, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. So Jesus is referred to here in verse 24 as Jesus is the mediator and the messenger of the new covenant. So back to Daniel chapter 9, it says that he, verse 27, and we take that among the Church of God people to be talking of Jesus, he, Jesus, shall, because he is the mediator of a new covenant, confirm a covenant with many for 7 years. But in the middle of that, he himself is slain, and so 3.5 years confirming the covenant, which of course then leaves 3.5 years yet to be confirmed. And that is, by and large, what God's people have believed over the years, that Jesus did it for 3.5 years in person before he was crucified, and he's got 3.5 years yet to do. 3.5 years is yet to be confirmed by Jesus Christ to his people. Okay, when might that take place? Well, this is where there's a couple of different directions you can go. Some people reckon the 3.5 years instruction will happen in the place of safety before we are changed. You turn to Revelation chapter 12. And we'll read verse 14. Revelation 12 and verse 14. You've got to read between the lines on this one. But it says here, verse 14, "But the woman," that be the Church of God, we believe, "was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent." Well, we take the time, times and half a time to be 3.5 years. And the church is nourished there. Now that could mean that there's a kiosk that serves cheeseburgers and things. But I think the assumption has always been that that you and I, if we are there, will be nourished spiritually. It'll be the last 3.5 years of, what was it called, my the place of final training, I think, was how it was once referred to, the place of final and intensive training. And so the one thought is that, well, Jesus has confirmed the covenant for 3.5 years, then was cut off. This must be where the other 3.5 years comes in, when the covenant is confirmed to God's people in the place of safety, where they're receiving their final training, and that's where the 3.5 years fits in. Well, okay, maybe, maybe not. The other view by some in the Church of God is that it's the first 3.5 years in the millennium. Okay, that when we are changed at the last trump and zoom up into the clouds, and then we meet with Jesus and so on, that the first 3.5 years of our spirit lives is when Jesus, if you like, completes this particular portion of his work. He was with his disciples for 3.5 years, taught them personally, day by day, showed them how to raise the dead, walk in water, multiply loaves and fishes, and that for 3.5 years in the millennium, the first 3.5 years, Jesus will complete this particular task. Okay? So that's the first explanation of this rather mysterious verse 27. Jesus confirms the covenant 3.5 years before he was crucified, and 3.5 years yet to come, either in the place of safety or perhaps early in the millennium. Is there proof of that? No, but that's just, I mean, the general views of the Church of God over the years. A second view is that if you look back to verse 24, it says 77s are determined for your people and for your holy city, talking to Daniel, who was of the tribe of Judah. And therefore this view is that everything we said so far applies, but it relates purely to the Jewish people. Okay, and that says that Jesus was indeed the person who confirmed the covenant with many for 1 week. So that's fair enough. Jesus preached to the Jews, did he not? Yeah, that's true. Jesus was in the Galilee and Judea and ended up, of course, being arrested and crucified in Jerusalem. So Jesus preached for 3.5 years and was cut off in the middle of the week. Interestingly, of course, he was actually killed on a Wednesday, which was the middle of the physical week. But then this, the next view is that, yeah, well, what happened then was after the resurrection of Jesus, when he went to heaven, he then continued to teach the Jewish people for 3.5 years, from 31 AD up till about, you know, 3.5 years later. And then something happened, and the message to the Jews, by and large, came to an end. That was deemed to be the martyrdom of Stephen. If we turn to Acts chapter 6. So this view is that the whole 7 years are now over and done with, 3.5 before Jesus' death and 3.5 immediately after, when Jesus from heaven continued to work through his apostles directly and intensively with the Jews, the people of Daniel, taking us to the martyrdom of Stephen, at which point the main message to the Jews was essentially over. Let's see that. We turn to Acts chapter 6. And picking up the story in verse 8. Stephen was, of course, an outstanding... Well, they all seem to be outstanding people, don't they? Ezra, Daniel, Stephen, even the way we fit in the league table there. Stephen, full of faith and power, did great wonders and signs among the people. So he was outstanding, simple as that. And the people looked at him with some amazement because he did great wonders, not just wonders, but great wonders and signs. He was full of faith and power. But of course, that soon came to the attention of the Jewish leaders. Verse 9, then there arose some from what is called the synagogue of the freedmen, disputing with Stephen. Verse 10, and they were not able to resist the wisdom and spirit by which he spoke. Then they secretly induced men to say, we have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God, which of course was, lies. And they stirred up the people, the elders and the scribes, all Jews, and they came upon him, seized him, and brought him to the council. So it's shades of what happened to Jesus. I remember they got all manner of false stories about Jesus and accused him of blasphemy and dragged him before the elders and the council. So same story to Stephen. And the view being expressed here about the prophecy of Daniel is that this was 3.5 years after Jesus' ascension to heaven. This was 3.5 years during which Jesus had been preaching through his body, the church, the apostles, the likes of Stephen, to the Jewish people in Jerusalem, headquarters. Verse 13, they also set up false witnesses, just like with Jesus, who said, this man does not cease to speak blasphemous words against this holy place and the law. And of course, Daniel talked about the holy city. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and change the customs which Moses delivered to us. And all who sat in the council, looking steadfastly at him, saw his face as the face of an angel. So he's called to account. And he makes a very public declaration. Chapter 7, verse 1. The high priest, Caiaphas, said, are these things so? Are you saying this about our God and his holy place and Moses and the customs? And then, we won't read it, but Stephen goes into a very detailed history of the people of Israel, getting right down to the Jewish leaders, and then we pick up the story in chapter 7, verse 51. He now brings it to a fairly brief, was a brief point, because he was dead a few minutes later. Verse 51, you stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit, as your fathers did, so do you. So he really piles it on here, clearly under inspiration, because the Father and Jesus were watching very closely, as we find out in a moment. This was, I think, a very gripping event, even in heaven. And one imagines the angels and demons and God himself and Jesus were all, if you like, watching very closely. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? Tell me one. And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers. Now those are two emotive words. You are betrayers and you are murderers of the Just One. You have received the law by the direction of angels and you have not kept it. When they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, my margin says, furious, and they gnashed at him with their teeth. But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God, outstanding, and Jesus, not seated at the right hand of God, but standing, almost standing up in, I guess, excitement or in support, encouragement, admiration, who knows, but Jesus standing, and Stephen could see him. So this was a very, very dramatic, a one-off. Has this ever happened since? I doubt it. And said, look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. And they cried out with a loud voice, stopped their ears, ran at him with one accord, cast him out of the city and stoned him. And the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul, and they stoned Stephen as he was calling on God and saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. Then he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not charge them with this sin. And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Well, he died. Brains bashed out by rocks and boulders. Outstanding. But the view here is that, well, that was 3.5 years to the Jews. And from this moment on, well, you can see what happens, verse 1 of chapter 8. Now Saul was consenting, it implied with delight, to his death. At that time, a great persecution arose against the church, against the teachers, against the truth, which was at Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except just the apostles. In the next chapter, we see Saul being converted and given his mission to the Gentiles. The chapter after that, Peter is told that, you know, God is calling Gentiles not to call them unclean. So really, Stephen's martyrdom, when he was given this incredible vision of Jesus, the Lord, standing up in admiration, seems to bring to an end the, if you like, the exclusive ministry to the people of Daniel. So this particular explanation of the 7 years, let's go back to Daniel now, is that Jesus has now completed this 7 years. 3.5 years of his personal ministry to the Jews, and 3.5 years of his ministry up to the martyrdom of Stephen, and that's it finished. So the whole 70 weeks are now elapsed. So on the one hand, you've got a view that says 3.5 years done, big long gap, 3.5 years yet to be done in the place of safety or the millennium. Another version says, nope, it's been done, it was directly to the Jews, that has been fulfilled, end of story. And those are both views that circulate within the Church of God. The third view is the one that you'll probably come across if you are ever speaking to people who are in the sort of evangelical churches out there, people who believe in the rapture and so on. They have a very different take on this. And this version is as follows. Let's go to verse 27. Well, let's go back to verse 26, I guess. We're talking about Messiah being cut off. But then they talk about the next prince is actually, as they see it, the Antichrist. I'll just plug in that word to make it sort of plain what they believe. This is what probably millions and millions believe if you've come across the Left Behind books, which are apparently the best-selling book series of all time, and have produced, I think, at least 3 films, Left Behind films, and they are very popular, and they sort of picture a fairly general view of this prophecy from the average Bible-studying Protestant out there. And they believe it goes as follows. Verse 26, after Messiah's cut off, and the people of the prince, brackets, Antichrist, who is to come, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. At the end of it shall be with a flood, and till the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he, the Antichrist, okay, I'm putting in words here like they would want, then he, the Antichrist, shall confirm a covenant or treaty with many for 7 years. For in the middle of the 7 years, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, brackets, he will cause to cease the Jewish sacrifices at the temple, close brackets, and then it concludes. So their view is that it's talking here of the Antichrist. He will confirm a covenant or a treaty with the Jews for 7 years. Okay, so as far as they're concerned, this is yet to happen. As far as they're concerned, somewhere in the next few years, a individual is going to make peace in the Middle East and confirm with the Jews a covenant or a treaty or an agreement for 7 years. But, and of course in that early part of that, the Jews will start sacrificing at their temple, yet to be built. But halfway through that 7 years, he will betray them. Halfway through that 7 years, this Antichrist will do the dirty, and he will cancel, terminate, and stop the sacrifices. He will bring in some statue of some sort into the temple, the abomination of desolation, and that will then cause to erupt the last 3.5 years called the Great Tribulation. Right? So that's sort of the belief that is generally out there. I've got one little thing I copied off the internet an hour or so ago. This is a evangelical type church website, and it's answering questions from members and so on. Question: what is a tribulation? How do we know the tribulation will last 7 years? Because if you're speaking to any of your buddies out there in the present world, they'll probably tell you about 7 years of tribulation. And what they believe is at the beginning of the 7 years, you know, the goodies get raptured or ruptured, disappear from the scene, and then a 7-year treaty, and then halfway through it, this Antichrist, betrays the Jews, halts the sacrifices, and that brings in the last 3.5 years of the great tribulation. So question: what is a tribulation? How do we know the tribulation will last 7 years? Answer: the tribulation is a future 7-year period of time. The church will not be present during the tribulation. The church will be removed from the earth in an event known as the rapture. And a few scriptures are quoted. Okay, so at the beginning of the 7 years, cars crash into lampposts, lorries overturn, planes fall out of the sky because pilots and drivers have been raptured away. All that's left, according to the Tim LaHaye videos and movies, is simply, you know, your trousers and jacket will be there and your shoes and socks, but you'll have disappeared naked up to the clouds. Carries on this particular article. An understanding of Daniel 9:24-27 is necessary in order to understand the purpose and time of the tribulation. So that's why I'm referring to it, because this is the passage that the present world looks to for its 7 years of tribulation. I'm cutting through the stuff here. One more paragraph to quote. Daniel 9:27, and that's where we are camped at the moment. Daniel 9:27, says this article, gives a few highlights of the 7-year tribulation period. Daniel 9:27 says, quotes, "And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate." And it continues, "The person of whom this verse speaks is the person Jesus calls the abomination that makes desolate, Matthew 24:15, and is called the beast in Revelation 13. So they're saying that the one who confirms a covenant is actually the beast or the Antichrist. Daniel 9:27 says that the beast will make a covenant for 1 week, 7 years, but in the middle of this week, 3.5 years into the tribulation, he will break the covenant, putting a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. Revelation 13, it says, explains that the beast will place an image of himself in the temple and require the world to worship him. Then it says that the great tribulation is the last half of the 7-year tribulation period, when the abomination that causes desolation, the beast, will be in power. So that's their version. So you get three options at least there. There's probably elements as well. And it all boils down to who the he is, in a sense. So plenty of food there for thought. Like with all prophecy, it's quite easy when you look back at fulfilled prophecy to sort of slot in what it means and what it represented. When you come to prophecies yet to be fulfilled, we have to accept we see through a glass darkly. We have outlines, we see sort of shady views. It's never absolutely dogmatically clear. So in summary of that particular passage there, you have got either Jesus confirming the covenant for 3.5 years, with 3.5 yet to come, choose the place of safety of the millennium. Jesus confirming the covenant for 3.5 years in person, and then to the Jews for 3.5 years afterwards until Stephen was martyred. Or if you feel like joining the millions who believe in the rapture, you have got a Antichrist yet to agree a 7-year covenant with the Jews. Halfway through it, he will betray them, stop their sacrifices, and that will usher in the great tribulation, which is the final half of the tribulation. Well, okay, hopefully that's as plain as it's going to get for this time through the book of Daniel. Maybe next time we do the book of Daniel, further illumination will have arrived, but that's where we'll leave it for now. Okay, moving on to chapter 10. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. In those days I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till the 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. So, you know, Daniel is hungry for revelation and understanding, and he sets himself to understand. So he's, in a sense, fasting here. No pleasant food, no luxury items, no chocolates. Okay, no chocolates mentioned here. But in fact, no meat or wine or no glasses of Corona either. And didn't anoint himself. He's fasting and he's humbling himself for 3 whole weeks. Verse 4. Now on the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with gold of Uphaz, which I imagine must be top class gold. His body was like a beryl, here she is, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like torches of fire, his arms and feet like burnished bronze in color, and the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. So, quite a striking individual. I guess we see this as being an angel, because his, you know, his face is like lightning, just bright and shining. His eyes like torches of fire. His arms and so on like burnished bronze, and his voice just a deep resounding sound like many, many voices speaking at once, rich and authoritative. And I, Daniel, verse 7, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great terror fell upon them, so that they fled to hide themselves. They knew something was happening, and they did the noble thing and raced off as far as they could to hide under the bushes. And therefore I was left alone when I saw this great vision, and no strength remained in me, for my vigor was turned to frailty in me, and I retained no strength. Yet I heard the sound of his words, and while I heard the sound of his words, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. So poor old Daniel, now in his 80s, is just seeing something that turned his knees and his legs to water, and down he goes. Verse 10, then suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. So I guess he's on all fours at this point, on his knees and his hands, and just sort of half kneeling there. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved. And we heard that before. Daniel was a greatly beloved individual. O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you, and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. There's a bit of a buzz appearing on my phone here. I'm not sure if you can hear it or not, but in my earpiece is quite a nasty buzz. I'll keep on talking and hope you can hear the voice. So verse 11. Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you, and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling. So he's getting upright now, but he's still very nervous in the presence of this very strange individual. He said to me, do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. Well, you'll recollect that Daniel had started some 21 days earlier, remember? For 3 full weeks, Daniel was going before God. He was humbling himself. He was avoiding luxury foods and so on. And this angel says, Daniel, from the very first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. So what we see here is that when Daniel started, God sent the answer. You know, Daniel was asking God for revelation, for wisdom, for insight, and immediately it says God sent it. But notice verse 13, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. Now, who is the prince of the kingdom of Persia? Well, who could withstand an angel like Gabriel? Who could withstand an angel like Gabriel? You know, just an ordinary prince in the human kingdom of Persia? Well, of course not. No human being can hold back an angel. Angels are far stronger and mightier and more powerful than you and I are. But it says here that an individual, referred to here as the prince of the kingdom of Persia, withstood or opposed Gabriel for 21 days. So clearly we're talking here about another angelic being, another demonic force. It could be that this was actually Satan himself, or potentially one of Satan's hierarchy, some principality, some prince in the demonic realm that actually withstood and held back Gabriel. And it says, verse carrying on, behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, see, now Michael we know is an archangel, called here a chief prince. Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia. So it looks like Gabriel being left there looking after, perhaps protecting the kings of Persia, like Darius and Cyrus and so on. And remember, this time God was working through Cyrus and Darius to allow the Jews to go back, from the country back to Jerusalem to rebuild the city and the temple and so on. And therefore, there were things needed to be done. And it looks like Gabriel was assigned the task of being there with the kings of Persia, making sure that what needed to happen happened, and perhaps guarding them against Satan. If you think about what Satan will be doing at this time, Satan hates God's purpose and plan, and Satan can see that, God is opening up an opportunity here for some Jews to go back to Jerusalem. They're going to rebuild the temple. Oh, what can I do to stop that? How can I stop God's plan? And we know that, if you think of the book of Esther as an example, that Satan worked through Haman, remember, to try and get all the Jews in the entire kingdom exterminated. So you can see that there'd be a lot of things happening in the spirit realm. And so it looks like Gabriel had been given an assignment to protect, direct the kings of Persia, but as being withheld now by this prince of Persia, a strong demon force. And 21 days earlier, he'd been told by God to take this message to Daniel. Couldn't do it. The prince of Persia held him back, caused too many problems. And it required Michael, one of the archangels, to be sent to help Gabriel and release him and give him the time to get on to see Daniel. Verse 14. Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days. For the vision refers to many days yet to come. When he had spoken such words to me, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. And suddenly, one having the likeness of the sons of men touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke, saying to him who stood before me, my Lord, because of the vision, my sorrows have overwhelmed me, and I have retained no strength. For how can this servant of my Lord talk with you, my Lord? As for me, no strength remains in me now, nor is any breath left in me. Then again, the one having the likeness of a man touched me and strengthened me, and he said, O man, greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be to you. Be strong, yes, be strong. So when he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. I've got to get back there and take care of things with the prince of Persia, this strong demonic force. And when I have gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth, and then in brackets, no one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince. Also, chapter 11, there's really no chapter break, I guess, in the Hebrew, so you really, it's actually in brackets in my Bible, the tail end of verse 21, the first part of chapter 11 is all in one set of brackets. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. So, the angel was given this task of strengthening the kings and making sure that they did what God wanted. which was to allow the Jews, Ezra and Nehemiah, to carry on their good work back in Jerusalem. And there's no question that, of course, you know, Satan would be working hard to bring that to an end. You've only got to read through the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, Esther, to see how much opposition, how many problems continually occurred against the poor old Jews. But chapter 11 we're now moving into. Chapter 11 is the longest prophecy in the Bible, so says Mr. Herbert Armstrong, and there's no way I can really do justice historically to chapter 11. It's a very long chapter. There's lots and lots of details of what took place in Persia, in Greece, in Egypt, in Rome, in Judea, down through century after century after century. The best thing in some ways, if you want to go into in detail yourself, is to read Mr. Armstrong's article. He wrote a booklet or a book entitled The Middle East in Prophecy. The Middle East in Prophecy. That booklet is available on lots of places. If you go on the internet, it's on my website, tavencog.net, The Middle East in Prophecy. And Mr. Armstrong goes through virtually every verse in chapter 11, verse by verse, verse by verse, verse by verse, explaining what took place historically. And he quotes from a number of history books to show you that everything that's in Daniel chapter 11 was fulfilled bit by bit, bit by bit. I hope you can hear me. This buzzing in my ears is really quite distracting, so I'm hoping you can hear it at your end.
It's not the teleconference line. I've checked it.
My wife's telling me it's not on the teleconference line, so perhaps it's just my earpiece.
No electrical interference from someone, a computer.
So, moving on to chapter 11 and verse 2. So, the angel is now bringing Daniel some very detailed information about the prophecy, and it runs all the way through a couple of pages in my Bible, and is detail by detail. Verse 2. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Now, Mr. Armstrong and a number of commentaries will tell you that the fourth one is referring to Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S, Xerxes. And he was far wealthier than the rest, and he did go to battle against the coming king of Greece. But then verse 3, a mighty king shall arise, talking of Alexander the Great, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he is arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven. And we've seen that before, do we not, in Daniel 7 and 8. Alexander the Great was a tremendous warrior, a great leader. He managed to capture a whole swathe of the known world, all the way down to India. By the age of 33, he had conquered the world. There was nothing left. Oh, that buzzing seems to have gone now. So that's a relief if somebody's just muted. My brain was just starting to fry slightly. Verse 4. So Daniel had arisen as a great, mighty king. But when he died, aged something like 33, his kingdom was broken up into four parts. Remember the four horns of the leopard and so on. But not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. And really from this point on, the Greek empire split into four horns, four wings, it says four winds of heaven here. And the story through Daniel 11 onwards follows the history of just two of them. Four parts, north, east, south, and west, but only two parts. It trails from now on, verse 5, to the end of chapter 11. It follows the story of the king of the north and the story of the king of the south. So the two are not part of the picture here, but these two kings, two empires, north and south, king of the north, king of the south, are what we follow from now on. It becomes relevant because there's lots of information. I said I can't add much value to verses 5 through to sort of 30-odd because it's all just detailed history, which I don't know a huge amount about. But Mr. Armstrong and others will give you the details there, so I'll just read through it for the sake of completeness. But if you want the detail, and it's amazing in a sense, that's why some people say, well, hang on, Daniel didn't write this. I mean, Daniel lived about 540 odd BC. The details here take us down through the 300s BC, the 160s BC, take us down to the sort of the 20s AD, take us right through to the 2007s. Hang on a second, this wasn't possible. And so they assume that the book of Daniel was written much, much later, after these events took place. Otherwise, you've got to admit there's a God, and that he prophesies accurately, and that he can make things come to pass. And of course, many people say, well, that's not right, there's no God, and this is only just Jewish writers, and so on and so forth. Verse 5. Then the king of the south shall become strong, and in this time the king of the south was really Egypt, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and of dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. I think it was a marriage agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. It's very complicated if you try to read through it rapidly, but there's three people mentioned there, and all three of them died. They all died or were murdered around about 246 BC, according to my inspired marginal note. Verse 7, but from a branch of her roots, that would be her parents, one shall arise in his place. That would be her brother. That was a branch of her parents, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. That was this lady's brother. She was Berenice, and her brother was Ptolemy III. And so you can see that there's so much detail you get into here that I once thought of putting all the details in my margins, but frankly there's no room in my margins for all the details you'd need. The best thing is to get Mr. Armstrong's book, Middle Eastern Prophecy, and then if you go through this in your Bible verse by verse, Mr. Armstrong gives you the fulfillment verse by verse. Verse 8, he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Then, verse 9, the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. There's lots of battles going to and fro here. However, his sons, this is the king of the north's sons, shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. Now, this is talking of the sons of the king of the north, and there's one son features for a few verses here. Antiochus is the son. There's more than one Antiochus knocking about. This particular one is Antiochus the Great, an unusually humble man. Antiochus the Great, and he was of the king of the north. Verse 11, the king of the south shall be moved with rage to go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude. But the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up. This is Antiochus the Great. And he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. And in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also, says the angel, certain violent men of your people, Daniel, shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. And it turns out historically that, yes indeed, many of the Jews actually assisted Antiochus the Great against the king of the south. Verse 15, so the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city. The forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. Antiochus the Great is a victor. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land of destruction in his power. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. And Antiochus, one of these political marriages, gave his daughter to the king of the south, trying improve his standing, try and get more power and influence that way. Didn't work, apparently. After this, verse 18, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. This ruler, Mr. Armstrong points out, is really talking about one of the Roman generals who started to stand up against Antiochus and brought reproach against him. Verse 19, then he, Antiochus, shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. And indeed he was killed himself in 187 BC. And how could Daniel, writing about 539 BC, prophesy in what was a very, very detailed manner, events to take place hundreds of years later? This is what, the atheists struggle with. Well, it can't be right. And this cannot have been written by a man 500 BC, because if you look through history, it works. I mean, the language and prophecy, of course, sometimes a bit difficult. But all of these verses, you can actually equate them to something that specifically took place, which fits the prophecies. And Mr. Armstrong proves that. Verse 20, there shall arise in his place, Antiochus' place, one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. Turns out that was Seleucus IV, who raised bunches of money through a tax collector called Heliodorus. It's all there. It's in history. The story's there. Encyclopedias have got it. Carrying on, it says, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. Well, the few days was 11 years, and he wasn't destroyed in anger or battle. He was poisoned by Heliodorus. Poisoned his master Seleucus. So, like, it's all there, bit by bit. Verse 21, And in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honour of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably, but seize the kingdom by intrigue. Now, this is another Antiochus. This is the one we've come across before. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. This is God manifest in the flesh. This is the guy that entered Jerusalem. Remember, we read in Daniel 8, and they caused destruction and slaughtered pigs on the altar and put a pagan statue in the Holy of Holies. This is the man just arriving to the scene now. We're down now to the 170 odds BC thereabouts. So in his place, it says, verse 21, shall arise a vile person, an awful person, a stench person, to whom they will not give the honour of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably, and yet he'll seize the kingdom by intrigue. And when we were in Daniel 8, looking at the little horn, if you remember that far back, and Antiochus Epiphanes, we said that's really just a type, because the prophecy is actually for the end time, not for way back then, but for the end time. And so when we see the behavior here of Antiochus Epiphanes, this vile person, we can see some hints of what will happen in the future. This guy comes in peaceably, but then he takes over the kingdom by intrigue, by strategy, by deceit. And I guess the question we've got is, when we get to the end time, will this individual, this little horn who's prophesied, he said to be master of intrigue, is that going to happen? He'll be appointed as a peacemaker of some sort, and then gradually he'll take over the European empires by intrigue. Verse 22, with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant, talking of the high priest. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. That's how he behaves. And the end time be even worse. For he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province. And he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches. And he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts, north and south, shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it shall not prosper them, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. And he massacred many Jews on the way back. We'll have to finish in a moment. At the appointed time he shall return, verse 29, and go toward the south. But it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyrus, or Cyprus I should say, which is was a Roman territory, shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. He was defeated by the Romans out at sea. He was enraged, filled with anger. He returned to the Middle East, to Jerusalem, and it says he showed regard for those who forsook the Jewish religion. Verse 31, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. They shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there in the sanctuary the abomination of desolation. Took place about 167-168 BC. Those who do wickedly against the covenant he shall corrupt with flattery. And so that takes us down to about 167 thereabouts BC. Antiochus Epiphanes, the vile man, is now in Jerusalem. He's a killing, destroying, taking away the daily sacrifices, erecting the abomination of desolation in the sanctuary, which we've covered somewhat before. And that's me right out of time. My engineer is telling me to shut up and close down before we run out of space on the desk. So with that, we'll conclude our Bible study rather abruptly for today.